So 30 times since 1994, the finance minister has stood up in front of parliament and his peers and delivered a budget speech. What we, the audience, have always thought to be a well-considered and well-researched speech. We may grumble about the issues of sin taxes here and there. But this year, lo and behold, just before the man had to give his speech, we all got the notifications that it has been delayed. Something went wrong. Back then, it was easy. The ANC had a simple majority, so they could pass the speeches as and when. And now, everybody is scrambling. The DA is going to court. We're not sure what exactly is happening, and Herman Mashaba is flummoxed. So today, to help me understand, because now suddenly we're also hearing all sorts of other terms. Before, it would be the budget speech, it would be all the bills that go with it, and that is it. No fanfare, and fiscal, and treasury, and its fiscal responsibilities continue. And today, with a coalition government, we have people sitting in parliament, all, whether they are in the ANC or the opposition or the GNU or outside the GNU, everybody has something to say, and the sound bites don't really make sense. And so to help me today, I have got my friend, and you know him too, Mark Oppenheimer, who is a legal commentator and a member of the Joburg Bar, and somebody that we often turn to here at Level Up and before with the Burning Platform to help us understand some of these legalities. And he's brought a friend. He's introduced me to Kristen Heim, who will be joining us. She holds a PhD from the University of Cape Town and is also a research fellow at the Center for Democracy Research. And she is about helping governments and parliaments capacity build, and also, she tells me, a self-declared fan of the underdog, and she believes that parliament is an underdog, and her expertise in budget, tax and parliamentary processes makes her the perfect person to come in and chat with us. Kristen, thank you for your time and coming in and helping me figure this out and helping my viewers level up what actually is going on in South Africa. And thank you to you too, Mark, for coming in. I'm going to start with Kristen, because this is your world, working with parliaments, not just South African, but across the continent, and understanding how they work and the budgetary processes around it. So what should have happened and what didn't happen? What went wrong? Why are we here?
Oh, that's an excellent question, Pumi. And first off, thanks for having me here. It's an absolute pleasure. And I love the opportunity to speak about the subject that most people walk away from. So honestly, if I say I work with parliaments and I work with budgets, people slowly creep backwards. So I'm very happy we can engage on this. In a delightful sort of way, in a collaborative way. What went wrong? I mean, I can say, I would rephrase the question. I would say, what went right?
Okay.
I would turn that one completely upside its head. Because when it comes to issues like the budget, what has to happen is we need to have a deliberation. It's the political skeleton of the country. It's stating what the priorities are. It's filled with values and what matters, the things to which we attend. And if we're not talking about that in an open manner, if it's not participatory, then it really loses its meaning, because, I mean, clearly we're not going to be aligned. Any budget is never going to be enough. There's scarce resources. That's the bottom line. Mm-hmm. So what happens in the budget process is that we try to make room to discuss how we can manage this time around to allocate those resources and to generate resources for that allocation, right? It's not just about expenditure. It's also about the revenue.
So Kristen, before...
So when...
You go.
So I just wanted to say, when it comes to the budget process and what's happening right now in South Africa, I would see this in a more positive light than a negative one. I see that any sort of deliberation on this on the subject, and participation. The mere fact that we're here talking about this is amazing. That people are thinking about it and are interested in it. It absolutely has to happen. We need to you know, demystify this whole process and what's been going on, because I think for the first time we're really seeing how a real budget process works.
Kristen, so before, the minister would deliver his speech and then there would be all of the parliamentary deliberation afterwards, right? Also, Trevor Manuel used to ask for tips for Trevor. You remember that? But this time around, that process seems to have been turned on its head, because, you know, he didn't deliver the speech and then he was going to deliver a speech. Now he's delivered a speech and he says that they have been, you know, with tax and whether we're getting more VAT or not. And Herman Mashaba seems to think that we're not getting more VAT. But I got an SMS saying we are getting more VAT from all my service providers. So everybody that I pay on a monthly basis has told me that there's going to be VAT implications, right? And they are having, they're supposed to, they're in recess now, but they're supposed to have this conversation, but it still seems like it's not signed off. And then Mark, I want to bring you in, because you have read the founding affidavit. The DA has then go, that's it. I'm going to court. I'm taking this whole thing to court. There's been a breach of constitutionality here, and we need the courts to make a decision about how we move forward. So what does that mean, and how does that work? Because surely the work of Parliament happens ring-fenced outside of court process.
Well, one of the things that's beautiful about living in a constitutional democracy is that you have the supreme document of the Constitution, which means that when Parliament or the executive stray out of the bounds of that Constitution, you can have recourse in a court. Mm-hmm. So what the DA have done is they've brought a two-step process. So the first part, which will be heard urgently, is an interdict against the levying of the VAT hike. And they say that they're entitled to the interdict for two broad reasons. The one is that there is a legislative power which gives the minister the ability to adjust the VAT rate on his own. And they say that cannot be constitutional. It cannot be the case that the executive gets to determine taxation. Really, this is a matter for the people, for Parliament. So they sort of use the line, no taxation without representation. So you can't have the executive usurping the function of Parliament. It is for parliamentarians to decide what the VAT rate will be. And so to have delegated this to the minister through legislation is unconstitutional. That's the one claim. And they say that must be dealt with in a constitutional challenge, which will be, you know, launched at a later date, but they think they've got reasonable prospects of success on that case, and therefore in the interim, until that issue is resolved, the court should interdict the hike from taking place. Now, the other thing that they've pointed out is that the process to get to this budget framework was improper. So people were told that the DA and the EFF and the MK had signed off on the VAT hike when they said this isn't the case. And so the others were misled, and so you've got a procedural defect, and that's a further reason for saying, well, you must interdict this until we get to the bottom of it. And what the DA say as well is that you could never undo this wrong. So when you get an extra charge on your goods, you can't say to the taxman, hey, give it back to me. It turns out it was unlawful. It's already
They'll never give it back to you. But Kristen, this is your area of expertise, right? So where does the role of Parliament and the role of the executive, the Minister of Finance in this instance, where do the two meet? And is the DA got this right and the minister's got this wrong?
So I have to preface this by saying I didn't quite get all that Mark just said. Somehow something went wrong with the sound, but I'm going to try and jump in here.
Okay.
So if the relationship between the executive and the parliament when it comes to budgetary matters depends on the system type that we're working with, right? And so in South Africa, what you have is still a fusion between the executive and the parliament. The ministers are still doubling as members of parliament. And the parliament doesn't quite have its autonomy. At the same time, you have something of a strange sort of happening. The parliament and many parliaments in this area in Anglophone Africa are moving in this particular direction where they're actually trying to gain more autonomy and have more of a say in the budget process. And that particular fight was fought and won in South Africa in 2009 with the Money Bills Act. So parliament is actually, as an institution, in the right in terms of its ability to amend money bill legislation when it comes to tax or expenditure. It's actually quite exemplary for the region that it has gained this ability. The difference, or I should say the strange part about the whole scenario is that it hasn't been used yet. Parliament hasn't used these powers, but it absolutely is within its remit to do so. So typically, I mean, in most countries around the world, the executive is going to table the budget. The parliament is going to amend slightly and maybe more or less depending on, you know, its legal remit. But in very odd cases like the U.S. Congress, this is quite an anomaly. It's quite different. So the executive will table a parliament. The Congress will essentially tear it up and say, no, we're going to give you a whole new one. Yeah. That's very unusual. So I think it's really helpful to look at the executive, the relationship between the executive and the legislature in terms of its constitutional setup. So is it a parliamentary system? Is it a presidential system? Is it a semi-presidential system? That gives us a basic understanding of the relative autonomy of the legislature and its relationship to the executive with regards to the budget process. So, and I'll give you one other key. Yeah.
So I had never heard
one other key characteristic. So because
You and I getting ready for this show, and now when you say that Parliament hasn't had a chance to test it yet, and this is the opportunity, is this where the DA has a leeway in going to court and not keeping this as a parliamentary process?
Look, I mean, from me, when we first started breaching this subject and we started sort of teasing it out, the different bits of it, and maybe some people are looking at the constitutionality of this or the structural strangeness of this. But at the end of the day, it seems to me that this is an issue with the coalition and the newness of the coalition and the inability of the coalition itself to actually come to an agreement and do their job as collaborators, right? They have to figure this out. This takes a long time to learn how to make decisions together. I mean, it's not an easy process. It's not surprising this would happen now. But in terms of the parliament's ability to affect money bills and make amendments, that is absolutely a hard-won right that the parliament in South Africa has. And that it is really so interesting and so, I don't know, hopeful, maybe... I mean, people would argue, is this a good thing or a bad thing that parliaments can get involved in the budget? The danger is overspending, because then parliaments would tend to want to provide spending towards their pet projects or their pet people. On the other hand, if they're not involved, what happens is we lose sight of the oversight and the accountability aspect, right, is not there. Because if parliament isn't privy to all this information about what's going on with revenue and expenditure, if it's not thinking with the government, it can't possibly call it out when things are going wrong. Mm-hmm. So it's a trade-off and a balance, like most of these things. But, you know, for me, from my vantage point, I see this as really an issue within the coalition and not an issue with the parliament, if that makes sense.
That does make sense. And Mark, I want to bring you in here because you've been very vocal and also with other bills have been to Parliament and presented to parliamentary committees. And we are in a new place as South Africa, as we watch the machinations of this coalition and at all times the precarious nature of it as well. From your perspective and your experience, looking at this precarious kind of dance that is happening, do you think that there is big political winners and big political shifts happening and that it'll have an impact at the polls, maybe for South Africans?
Well, there's a sense in which there's already been a big political loser, being the ANC, right? So they were a party at 57.5% and are now at 40%. and they don't realize the position that they are in. They are acting as if they are still the dictatorial tyrant that they've been for the last 30 years. So they seem to be utterly aghast that the DA would have any problem whatsoever with their decrees. How dare you question what we're doing? You need to be a team player. You need to grease the wheels. So they don't really understand what it is to be in a coalition, which is that you don't get to do everything that you want. You have to make some compromises. And the kinds of things that the DA have asked for are really important. So the one is the Expropriation Act is a terrible idea. When you erode property rights in South Africa, it's bad for everybody.
Yeah, but right now, in this budget specifically, right? So the DA, there are many other things that we can talk about with the coalition and with all of the give and take, as it were. But at this particular moment, where there are frameworks in place and there is a need for parliamentary oversight, and the failing to push your way, you know, to throw your weight around in your coalition, and then going outside of parliament where the people who are elected represented, then saying to people who are not elected, essentially who have been put there by the president, as it were, judges, to say, you come in and solve our problem. Is the DA not finding itself kind of, you know, so on the one hand, the ANC has probably given them an opportunity to score a goal. And on the other, is the DA squandering that opportunity by not fighting it out in parliament with all the people that they have on their side?
Well, there's two things. So the first is, I think they did first engage in a negotiation process. So the reason why I bring up the expropriation bill is they said, you need to repeal this law because it's going to be damaging for our international reputation and for South African locals. If you do that, we'll be more likely to be on board with your budget. And they named a few other demands as well. Now, what the ANC did instead of negotiating with the DA was to rather bring in outsiders. And it helps that you've got someone like Action SA, who are political neophytes, who don't understand anything about the Constitution, who have just taken up a very small number of seats in Parliament, and think, oh, well, we could give them some advice, and that will count towards ensuring we don't have a VAT hike. So they sort of showed themselves up pretty poorly, because unless the DA case succeeds, we're going to have a VAT hike. And then Action SA are going to say, oh, we didn't realize that the ANC actually duped us into this. So, but the interesting thing for the ANC, of course, is what would it look like if you change the composition of the GNU? So if the DA say, we're out, we can't do this anymore, you now lead a coalition of like 9 parties, all of whom have a gun to your head, and are going to say, well, unless you do this thing, we're going to walk. And it's a very fragile number. I think it's like 201 if you include Bosa and those guys. So the ANC might find that governing under those circumstances is more difficult than governing with the DA. Also, obviously, big business doesn't like the prospect, and it looked like the GNU was severely on the ropes, and now they're back around the negotiating table because they kind of know they need each other. You mentioned what's going to happen at the polls. Well, the latest polling that's come out is that the ANC are polling below the DA for the first time in South African history. So both parties poll at around 30%, with the DA just marginally ahead. So it shows you that the ANC's hubris in this matter is not helping it, and that it is going to death spiral into insignificance, which of course would be a very good thing.
So, you know, I think everybody is now watching the Social Research Foundation's polling much more closely, you know, and kind of think what they're saying. A lot more people are paying so much more attention to it. But again, with the parliamentary process, and the reason I brought the two of you in is because parliamentary processes are legislative, right? They're actually laws, and they're about what happens going forward. And Kristen, when I started reading this 2009 bill, I had a sense that there's so much work happening in Parliament behind the scenes, but it doesn't quite seem that all of those processes arrive and are being put to the test by the parliamentarians themselves. Where we are now with the minister having put out a statement saying we're going ahead with the VAT hike, the DA if on Tuesday, when they get to court, they don't get their interdict, basically are going to be in a position where the VAT hike does go ahead, and there's still a need for deliberations within Parliament. The best way forward, in your experience and with your research and your knowledge, Kristen, what is the other way that this could be tackled and resolved?
Yeah, that's an excellent question, Pumi. So I think it's very easy in a place like South Africa, where we've had a one-party state for so long, to conflate, let's say, parliament with the party and government with the party. But like you're pointing to, what we're missing is in parliament, there are structures there and that are available that actually do the work in parliament in terms of taking the various viewpoints, filtering them through, and making the budget process itself something that could be considered fair, something that could be considered equitable, so that people can participate. And those are the committee systems. So the committee systems in any parliament are the sort of the workhorses of the actual institution. We've got a finance committee here in South Africa, an appropriations committee, and these committees are essential in terms of taking the information from the budget that's tabled and analyzing that. Now, that can be done in a variety of ways, and in each parliament, it does it differently. In fact, there's probably not an actual process in parliament that is more differentiated than the budget process, because there's so many factors that are involved. So you'll find it actually unfolds differently in each parliament. But you'll have, for example, like a finance committee or a budget committee that may take the budget on themselves. They may allocate certain sectoral budgets to different portfolio committees, or they may combine their work, but they're there working nonetheless. And what has to happen is that they will take this forward. They will do the analysis. And what's very important in South Africa, and which relates back to the Money Bills Act that you were highlighting here, is that if there's one sign that the parliament should be involved in the budget process, or let's say has license to be involved in the budget process, it is the existence of what's called a parliamentary budget office. Mm-hmm. These are incredibly difficult to establish. They're proliferating around the globe, not just in Africa, but around the globe, because parliaments are gradually taking a stand on issues of the budget where they had previously taken a back seat. Because what had happened over time, historically, is that the executive has amassed all the skill in terms of analyzing the budget and producing models. And, you know, they've got a staff, let's say, of maybe 100 people working on this.
Yeah,
whereas the parliament doesn't have that capacity. So what's happened in South Africa with the 2009 Money Bills Act is they established a parliamentary budget office that is there to provide parliamentary committees and individual members and anyone who needs that information with a neutral, nonpartisan analysis of the budget as it comes out, right? And so that is a huge asset, and it is something to really treasure and that the parliament needs to use. But the issue is, Pumi, that you don't want to bite the hand that feeds you. So the executive must fund the budget office. And we see time and time again where maybe the budget office says something that the executive doesn't want to hear, and they say, well, then you might want to go away, right? So yeah, we need to you know, look and see all the structures that are available, like the committees, like the budget office, and pay some attention to what's going on there, because that is where these issues are going to get solved. And it could be, whilst the coalition is squabbling or unable to make a decision, that the authority of these committees is going to be heightened, because they'll be the ones that are providing a stable structure in terms of the discussion and actually, you know, providing a method to the madness, so to speak.
Method to the madness. You know, I do think that for a very long time, and this is, you know, when we opened the show, I said for a long time, we've had a party with a simple majority. And now the work of politics, the work of reaching across the aisle and talking to your compatriots from other parties and bringing them on board is so necessary. You talk about an unwieldy coalition of 8-9 parties, but that's the work of politics. And that's the work that, you know, with our proportional representation system is the work that then says everybody essentially has a voice. You know, the small parties also have a voice, and they actually can use that voice. And it is, you know, if Gayton McKenzie wants a ministerial seat and the ANC feels that without Gayton McKenzie and giving him a ministerial seat, they're not going to be able to move these things along, it's important. And I'm wondering about the ability of our politicians, and just from the work that you've done in working with different politicians, do our politicians have what it takes to do that dirty work of politics, of kind of consensus building across party lines? Or no one wants to do that? They just want their way or the highway.
Well, if we look at what's happened in the cities where we've had coalition politics writ large for a number of years, it's largely been an unmitigated disaster. So if you look at Johannesburg, where you've had like fragile coalitions either run by the DA or by the ANC, the difficulty with having all these parties on board is that they can always leave at a moment's notice and backstab you. So it makes it very hard to implement things and get things done. There's an argument that we should have some kind of electoral reform, that you should have proportional representation like you do in Germany. But in Germany, what you also have is a threshold. So if you don't meet 5%, you don't get any seats. And the advantage of that is that it keeps out the sort of tiny strongman parties who have nothing to really add to the conversation. They don't have much of a constituency. Hardly anyone voted for them. But they're able to hold a knife to your throat and say, unless you give me X, I'm going to walk out. And so, you know, if you think about PE, for example, you had a party that had 2 seats and had the mayorship. And it was so corrupt and so rotten that even the ANC at some point found it embarrassing and decided to have the guy removed. But that's the situation we find ourselves in. You'd probably have more stability if you could sort of keep out some of the smaller parties. Maybe you don't have to set it at 5%. Maybe you just need to set it at like 1% or 2%. Also, you could have different thresholds, you know, when it comes to governing a city versus governing the state. You might think that at a national level, it's worth having a couple of small parties who can express a view and, you know, appease their constituency. I mean, after all, Helen Suzman was the only, you know, person who opposed apartheid, you know, during her tenure there. I think for 13 years was alone for the Progressive Federal Party. But, yeah, I think the difficulty we have is that a lot of it is my way or the highway. And that doesn't really work when you're supposed to make compromises. But it's not clear that the compromises that are sought are, you know, ideologically driven. It seems that they're driven by greed.
Well, I'm also interested to hear, Kristen, having worked across the continent, are we that different? Is this like, are we such an anomaly? Or are we just, because we don't look at what other people are doing or care about what's happening elsewhere, we feel this besieged? Is this something that happens normally in other places too? Or is this such an anomaly?
Are you speaking of, I wasn't able to hear Mark once again. Are you speaking of simply the,
so
the,
South
the
Africa,
difficulty in the coalition or in terms
of our difficulty in the coalition around this budget in Parliament right now? Is this an anomaly, or do such things happen in other places too? And how do they resolve them?
Oh, yeah, they absolutely, this is absolutely the normal business of Parliament. And like I said, that's why it's a good sign. I feel like it's a sign that the Parliament has a pulse, that it's alive, right? Mm. That something is happening there. Because when it's just a rubber stamp, if it's not engaging, if it's not debating, if there isn't some sort of tension involved, the work's not being done, because we have to, as I said before, it's scarce resources. There's a diversity of not just opinions, but needs and things like that. And particularly in South African society, I mean, it's so diverse, you know, in homogenous societies, let's say like the Netherlands or even Germany, even though it's much bigger in terms of population, you get things like consensus. And it's not to say that this happens everywhere, it happens all the time, but there's more of a chance for that kind of consensus to happen. Here you've got a greater challenge because of the greater diversity and the different socioeconomic needs that are vastly, apart from one another. This is very normal. I think sometimes it goes into a bit of a circus, I would say, in other countries. Like in Africa, maybe it's a never-ending saga. Sadly, it doesn't always end well, I would say, because there's not a lot of budget to go around to begin with, and things need to be taken care of. At the end of the day, we must get the budget passed so that implementation can happen and public services can flow again. So that's the whole idea. Mm. But I think that to answer your question, maybe very concretely, what had happened over the past 30 years, whereby there was no debate, that was the anomaly. This is actually how it really happens. And I just want to say one thing about what you were speaking to in terms of the capacity of the parliamentarians to engage in negotiations and whatnot. Now, I've been working with parliamentary capacity development for the past 16, 17 years now. And there's no credentials that are required of a parliamentarian when they enter. Mm. When they get to parliament, there's no job description. And the workplace has no set function where it can change over time and it changes over space. So you've got this very malleable institution. And when we deal with parliamentary capacity, we deal oftentimes with maybe the nuts and bolts of organizational behavior or maybe some information on a particular policy issue. But what you're speaking about right now, this ability to negotiate and to work as a team, that's something no one's really touched upon yet. We don't do that in parliamentary capacity development. And yet that is an essential skill because parliament is a team sport. It is not something you can do alone. And it really does make me wonder how, and this goes for people across the world. I mean, how do we solve issues with each other?
Yeah.
How do we solve problems with each other across the globe, right? When you're looking at a movie, there's a conflict and then they just fast forward to some sort of resolution, but we don't get to see how that actually plays out. And really, we lack the skills, I think, as humans in society, generally speaking, about how to resolve issues, how to negotiate, how to compromise. And so we can point fingers at the parliament and say, oh, this is a mess, this coalition. But yet it is hard for each and every one of us. And it's a skill that everyone should be investing in. And I'm not quite sure how to do that. But it is like human 101, right? How do we work together? And how do we make decisions together? And if someone could come up with some ideas about how we can grease the wheels on that kind of knowledge, it would be such a good thing.
So, you know, you say it's a team sport and it makes me feel bad about my next question. Worst case scenario, where we are today. What is the worst case scenario come Tuesday in front of the judge, in your view, Mark? With the DA's challenge?
Look, I don't think either scenario is a doomsday. In other words, the judge might very well say, there's something to see here, and so I'm going to grant the interdict. And I don't think South African society is going to collapse if you don't add a 0.5% increase on VAT. And it would show a kind of pushback against the idea of executive dominance. If the interdict isn't granted, I think people have expected that there'll be this 0.5% increase. And, the problem with that, of course, is that it's largely a regressive tax. So the people who are going to feel it the most are the poorest of the poor. And on that sense, the bright side of that going through would, of course, be that the ANC gets punished at the polls and will be sort of seen as the anti-poor party that it's been for a long time. Mm. So... no downsides.
No downsides.
See, look how cheerful I am.
Kristen, is there a worst case scenario going forward from where we are in your area of the workings of Parliament, and particularly as you say, this is a chance to test new legislation in the 2009 bills. Is there a downside, worst case scenario?
That's a tough question. I'm not a worst case scenario woman. I am an optimist. So it's you're pushing me into a corner. I don't occupy that space very often. A worst case scenario. I mean, maybe things can be obviously delayed even further, right? So we have, but it wouldn't even happen because there's what's called a reversionary budget. So if the parliament doesn't pass the budget, then it reverts back to the previous year's budget, 33%, something like that. So, you know, the show will go on. It's not as if, you know, public services couldn't go on if this were stuck. Maybe a worst case scenario would be that, the battles the political battles would supersede what's good for the country. Mm-hmm. You know, if politicians, if it was just a matter of fighting for power and people forgot what their duty was in terms of serving the people, that is always the worst case scenario, right? We don't want that to be the main show.
Yeah.
This is ultimately about how public servants serving the public, right? I mean, they could debate about, you know, what type of tax instrument and how much of, you know, in the scope of that. But people's they're required to govern and to make sure that things continue. And so I hope they don't forget that. I think that's the worst case scenario, is that people forget what they're there for. Maybe that's what I would say.
Sure. I think that that's quite a thing, because I do think that for ordinary South Africans, definitely for me, watching this whole thing play out, more than any other thing, I have felt that all of these politicians actually don't care. We're the ball that's being kicked around, that the South African public is the ball that's being kicked around, because they're all these machinations and all of this politicking and grandstanding on every side. And almost always when I listen to the sound bites, I feel like, that's not what you said last week, or that's not what you said yesterday, or that sounds slightly different. And that's one of the things that for me have been very top of mind, and also the driver of wanting to have this conversation, because suddenly again, we're hearing all sorts of new parts of how this thing works or should be working that we have never been made privy of. So I do agree with you, Kristen, that this is a good thing. This is a sign of a maturing democracy, but I don't know if we've got mature politicians.
So I think South Africans have this attitude where they just want everybody to get along with each other, and we should have a big social compact, and we must all hold hands and sing Kumbaya. And I don't think that's a very good idea. I think that what you have from the ANC is a sort of highly socialist policy agenda that is going to destroy the country. And you have a DA that's sort of realizing that they can annihilate their support by just going along with what the ANC's agenda has been, or they can put a line in the sand and say, this is where we're going to fight. And so it happens to be that they're fighting over the budget because they have actual power over this. They know that the ANC would struggle to pass it without them. I think they were surprised by the counter maneuvers that were made by some of the smaller parties. But I think it's very good that they're flexing their muscles here. And if they don't, and they just sort of said, well, you know, it will just be the more efficient ANC, which will, you know, help the ship sink quicker. We'll help drill more holes very rapidly because we're very good at getting things done. That would be a bad idea. And so what you don't want from the DA is sort of smoothing the process along. What you want is them throwing, you know, sand in the gears to slow things down and say, hold on a second, a lot of your objectives are bad objectives. That's why it's important that they introduced other concessions that had nothing to do with the budget in there. The other kinds of laws that are a problem for us and a problem for, you know, America and the sort of Trump executive orders, it's important to push back on that. And so as a political party, when you have a lever for power to achieve a good aim, you need to exercise it. And I think the DA are sort of realizing that it's important to use their own internal power that they have, and I think to rely on the external pressures that are being placed from abroad as well. But being a get-along gang, not a good idea.
do you think that the smaller parties are very cleverly positioning themselves too for, you know, in the jockeying, because everybody is fighting for the same electorate, right? So are the smaller parties, in your view, not playing the political game quite expertly, actually, to position themselves for the electorate and to say, we are on your side, we're fighting this fight, and these are the people that we're picking to be with in this fight, and hopefully will gain when the next poll comes around?
Yeah, if you think about it like a big board game, and of course it's a board game with people's lives on the line, if you're Action SA, you think, okay, we didn't join the GNU, we're a small party, but maybe we can make ourselves the reasonable opposition because the other opposition parties are maniacs, you know, the EFF and MK. So let's try and build up credit as holding the GNU to account. And at the first opportunity, instead of doing that, they slide in and do a deal with the ANC after saying, we will never do a deal with the ANC. So very short-term interests. I think it'll backfire. I'd be really surprised if Action SA get any seats in the next election. I think they're going to be like a Hang. I'm sure you have to dredge through your memory to remember Hang, but they kind of came in with 3 seats and now have 0. COPE, which came in at 8%, now have 0. So I think a lot of these smaller parties will cease to exist unless they play the game well. And I don't think some of those guys like Bosa, I mean, we're never going to hear from Bosa ever again. Raisa Mzanzi, who got $50 million in the election, are never getting a cent from their donors ever again. So some of these guys are just saying, well, look, this is our chance. We've got 5 years. Let's rape and pillage. Let's do as much as we can. But these are not good individuals who are going to, you know, make the country prosper, and they're not going to show up in any polls.
Mm-hmm. And for the people in Parliament, the workers, I often think we forget that there are people also working there, you know, in Parliament, because there are so many big personalities with the politicians. Kristen, for the people who are working and doing the research and dredging through all of these bills, these laws, and trying to hold the ship steady, as it were, in your view, do they have any prospect of being able to teach the rest of us on the outside so that we can support them and the work that they do anymore? Or is it just, that's just it, that's your day job, guys?
Well, it's an interesting thought, actually. The parliamentary staff and the administration, they're really the backbone for any parliament. And yeah, they're the unsung heroes by far, right? Because they are really trying to steer the ship, and it's often shaky. And they need to make sure they're not only holding onto the rails, but, you know, try to create a sense of stability for everyone else. But the idea that they would be able to have any reach to, you know, or engagement with citizens and educate or kind of pull them in is a bit far-fetched, I would say, because they're incredibly busy. So Parliament is one of the busiest places on the planet in any country. And then you've got the staff who are working around the clock to try and support their members or the committees or both or the departments. And so they're incredibly overstretched. I think it's interesting because the question of outreach, you know, the Parliament in South Africa, I think, has dabbled with this. Obviously, they're not quite successful yet. I think it's a very new thing that they've got someone that they've hired maybe this year, even if I'm not mistaken, that will head up efforts to create a bridge between citizens and Parliament. But I think there's also a really important bridge to be had between the universities themselves and Parliament. It's a tricky situation maybe in South Africa because that history is there, and I'm not sure, I wasn't around, I don't know how that actually transpired, but the idea, universities historically have been very close partners with parliaments, and they can help with things like educating the parliamentarians and at the same time providing civic education to students and those who are around in that area, even to the public, if they're maybe progressive or advanced in that way. I know, for example, the Center for Research on Democracy, Credo, with whom I'm associated now, they're doing what's called a citizens assembly, and they'll be inviting citizens to work on different policy issues. So that gives citizens an opportunity to kind of weigh in on things and maybe experience what it's like to make decisions collectively together, and how difficult it is to take information these days from the world and separate good information from bad. This is something parliamentarians, you know, have always had difficulties with, especially in the rise of increased specialization. So everything is more and more specialized. There's more and more expertise needed. You've got wider government reach. So government is in every single area of citizens' lives now. And yet they are more unsure maybe than ever about what good information is and what bad information is. It's called information literacy. And that's a big issue. And now with AI, that's going to even be a greater challenge, because then, you know, the question is, what's the source? How do we check the source? And convincing arguments are what every parliamentarian wants to have. And we'll have a lot of that. We'll have a lot of that. That will be in no short supply. But whether the information is going to really be able to give them traction in terms of making a better decision is the other question. So, ideally, we'd have people be more involved in parliamentary life, in helping to create their collective decision-making institution. Ideally, we'd have people that didn't see parliament as a four-letter word, that were engaged. But there, a lot of things have to happen in order for that to get to that point, right? It's a step-by-step process and a trust-building exercise, because trust in parliaments across the world has probably never been so low. Mm. So we have to start. And that's why when I speak to people about parliament, I don't use that word. I say our collective decision-making institution. I try to change it, because it's such a heavy term. It's loaded with emotion. And people then are blocked to actually understanding what goes on in there. And that's a real shame, because they are there to present again society, to represent, to present again. And if they're and they need help in doing that. They absolutely need people to see them, look at what they're doing, engage in what they're doing, and infuse their ideas and their preferences and values into that institution. It's a co-creation, let's say that.
Sure, it's a co-creation. I think that's a fantastic way of thinking about the work that we should be doing, all of us. You know, I definitely think, I wish more people read more, engaged more. But the time that you have taken to explain all of that you've explained to us, Kristen, is extremely helpful. And I think you've definitely helped me understand a little bit more thoroughly the nitty-gritty of what is going down. I also love the fact that you're saying parliament is not a four-letter word. Mark, I'm going to let you have the last word. If you were on the bench listening to this matter, what would your verdict be? What's your ruling?
I could tell you if I weren't prohibited from telling you. The bar rules don't let me prognosticate on litigation. So instead, what I'm going to do is comment on what Kristen said, which is, if you think about growing up in the 90s, we had parliamentary TV sort of available to us. And I remember watching, like as a youngster, being quite enthralled by seeing people persuading each other and engaged in reasoned discussion. And I think there was a sense of, you've got this new democracy where it's important that we show that the institution works and that it is a place of reason, not a place of mere power. And I think over time, people have lost interest in parliament. I don't think people imagine parliamentarians to be particularly skilled rhetoricians or good at giving arguments. I think they sort of see it as a place where, you know, those who have the votes will push through their agenda. And one of the things about no longer living in a one-party state is that you now need to persuade other people. And you've got different mechanisms for persuasion. You know, the one is basically you buy them. So you say, you vote for me on this and I'll give you something in exchange. And that could be totally corrupt and illicit, like we'll just give you sacks of cash. Or it's, okay, you want some things for your constituency, so we'll give you something like that. And that might be okay. And that might give those small parties a reason to be there. To say, look, we care about language rights, for example. And so we'll support X if you support us on language rights, because that's not a cost to you. One of the things that sort of surprisingly works well in South Africa is the ability for citizens to participate in the drafting of legislation. So we have public participation. So I've, you know, worked on behalf of clients and, you know, critique legislation, and a lot of our critiques were adopted. You had a big ramping up of that with something like Dear South Africa, which allowed the public to write their own submissions. And you had a lot of experts writing submissions from various different constituencies, but then you had average South Africans saying, I like this, or I don't like this, and this is why. And in that sense, we are quite a vibrant democracy. Often lobby groups get given a bad name in America. I don't think we have a really robust lobbying industry in South Africa, but actually the job of a lobbyist is really to speak on behalf of a constituency and try and persuade people why the law ought to look one way or another. And often as industry lobbyists, they have the best insight. So they know if you're going to, pass a certain piece of legislation, it could be devastating for manufacturers or retailers or farmers, whoever it is, and they can come in with their particular bit of knowledge. And Kristen's right to say that one of the skills that's very important is being able to adjudicate between two different sets of experts. So as a parliamentarian, when you're hearing these submissions, you often need to think, well, is this true? Are there good reasons to know that this is backed up with evidence? And how do I determine the truth when you've got people saying different things? How much of that is about the nature of reality, the descriptive things that are said, and how much of it is normative? In other words, what are we ought to do based on what we think our moral framework is or our legal framework is? And so it's important that you do have people who are skilled at being able to do this. And one story that sort of got almost no coverage, if you look at the particular individuals who represented the ANC in the prior parliament, 70% of them are no longer there. Partly, I think, because of an error the ANC made in compiling their lists. So you'll remember that when we voted, we had three different ballots. Mm-hmm. One of them was a regional ballot. And so a lot of people got put onto the regional ballot without the realization that they were not going to the regions, they were going to parliament. And so the DA understood this, and so they structured their list in a particular way with duplication. The ANC didn't. And so a lot of the people who, let's say, would have been in parliament for a long time are no longer there, and you've got a lot of people who are,
with institutional knowledge.
Yeah, yeah. A lot of newcomers are sort of coming in and going, look, this is not really the kind of institution that I understand, and are much more likely to sort of, follow whatever the party wishes are as opposed to exercising an independent mind.
And if there's anything that I take away from this conversation is that this is definitely a team sport, and the most important player actually is the South African public. And for a very long time, we've kind of relegated our role and kind of sat back and watched it all play out over there. And I love the fact that it's now becoming much more a conversation that more South Africans are participating in and kind of taking up the moment to look at. I hate the fact that it is at the cost of additional rands out of your pocket, but maybe that's the hard way that we've got to learn. That's the hard way we've got to learn. Thank you, Mark. Thank you for your time. As always, very illuminating. And thank you, Kristen. I'm so glad to know you. And thank you for sharing all of your expertise, your knowledge, and your experience with us this afternoon. And that's it. I hope
thanks so much for having me, Pumi.
Listening to all of this, you've got many more questions and definitely places to go in the rabbit hole, because there's a lot more reading to be done. There's a lot more understanding. And I hope that you're going to participate more. I mean, this is where you phone up your local councillor, your whatever your party is that you vote for. This is where you put up your hand and say, I want to be part of this. I want to be on the list if you have to be on the list. And thank you for joining us. We'll see you again next time on Level Up.